Hi, I'm James Brooks, and welcome to From the Factory Floor, a conversational podcast about all things startup and tech, brought to you by the folks at thestartupfactory.tech.
Hi everybody, welcome back to another episode of From the Factory Floor. Why did I get so tongue-tied then? From the Factory Floor. It's just me and Irie today. I've not got James with me, but I'm delighted to be joined by another founder who's going to share her journey and expertise and any advice that we can offer to other startup founders. So welcome, Georgia Gibson, co-founder of Uni. Hi, Georgia. How are you?
Hello. Thank you. I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. We were just having a little chat off air. Like, I know a little bit about your business, but it's quite nice that I actually don't know a lot. You're not based in Manchester, where most of the businesses I work for are based in. So it's going to be a really nice fact find podcast, and I've not got any sort of preempted questions or anything, just the generic ones that I think everybody will be wanting to listen to. So I think the best place, Georgia, to start is if you could just give us a little bit of an intro to yourself and a bit of background on Uni, if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course. I'm Georgia, and I am the co-founder of Uni. And what is Uni? Uni is an aggregate app for extracurricular life at university. So it's one place where students can find all of the events, all of the societies, everything that goes on beyond the lecture list. And as hard as it may be to kind of wrap your head around this, there is no centralized database for anything non-academic at university. And we are building that first database for all of the stakeholders, from societies to students, and also fundamentally kind of recruiters and alumni and all of that. And in terms of me and my journey to building Uni, I graduated from university, the University of Oxford, a year and a half ago. And I was very involved with kind of extracurricular stuff and became progressively aware of how much of an absolute fuck, am I allowed to swear? Fucking fuck it was, like, organizing it all. And, you know, you have Freshers Fair, which is this one day at your time at university where you're expected to, like, sign up to all the stuff you want to do for your next 4 years or three, 4 years, and you're probably hungover in that tent and you just want to leave. And then societies at the moment are using a plethora of different platforms, from getting sign-ups manually at things like Freshers Fair to then having long email lists, but I can tell you students do not really read those emails. Mm-hmm. And then having to use kind of Instagram, Facebook. No one is on Facebook anymore. Students are having to get Facebook just to join university to be part of these groups. TikTok, Eventbrite, Fixer, very high commission rates. And I saw the whole thing just completely scattered. And the impact on the student experience is not just administrative. It's actually deeply psychological in terms of what it has meant for student mental health. And fundamentally, it's meant that student isolation has gone up. People just aren't finding their people and their passions and their purpose in the same, and even their professions in the same way that they used to at university. And it's really affecting people's whole life, actually, beyond university as well.
Okay, fab. And actually, like, to bring a commercial angle to it, that then results in dropouts, doesn't it? Which,
yeah, big time. Yeah. Completely. And universities are now competing so much on student satisfaction and spending millions, and I say millions, I think the University of Manchester spent 4.3 million on mental health support. And most of that money, if I can say so, is being a little bit misspent, I would say, on kind of plaster solutions. So getting more counsellors in. And nothing against counsellors, but fundamentally we need to get to the root of the issue. And it's not meeting people once they're already unhappy. It's how can we actually make university more of an explorative, expansive time for students, and that is taking them beyond just the essays, as it were.
Fab. So essentially what we're saying is Uni allows people to find their tribe and engage in anything that's not...
I love that, yes.
Yeah, you can have that, you can have that one.
I'll pay you for it, but yeah, no, exactly.
You've done the podcast, that's the payment, thank you. So obviously you came out of Oxford Uni, you probably didn't go into Oxford Uni with the intention to start a startup, did you? But you saw a problem and decided to tackle it, which is great. Obviously not a lot of people do that. So what happened next? Like, what made you come out of university and go, I'm really going to throw myself into this rather than get a graduate position or any other kind of paid position?
I would say delusion is probably the main motivator there. I have this kind of frame of thinking about things where if no one else is doing something, I tend to think maybe it's because I'm the person to do it, and that I should there in fact do it, otherwise it won't get done. And that's kind of led to a series of quite adventurous and ambitious projects throughout my whole life, starting when I was very, very small. I've always been someone that has kind of built things on the side, side hustles, businesses, magazines, you know, and the like. And I I met my co-founder in my final year of university, and we started kind of ideating together. At the time, I was running a community of people sharing plans in London, actually. We had this thing called like plan prescriptions, where people would tell me where they wanted to go, how many people, the kind of theme of it, and I would prescribe them a plan. Got very into connecting people, allowing people to basically get out of their houses and heads. And then I was also working on another tech startup that was basically like TikTok Shop, or what is now TikTok Shop. And fundamentally, I realized that ethically, that was all about keeping people on their phones. And I knew that whatever I did, my businesses had to be about getting people off their phones and more involved with activities that promote delayed gratification. That's just been like a through line throughout my whole life. I don't really know exactly where that comes back from. I've thought about it a lot, but like that has always been consistent. It's about in real life interaction and delayed gratification. So then in terms of the courage to kind of leave uni and not go into a comfortable job, which sometimes I do question.
Yeah, we all do.
It's not easy. And there's a lot of reasons that tell you to quit on the daily. It's just that I was like, I just do think that I can do this and therefore I should. And I feel very privileged to come from a background which has given me the confidence in myself. Mm-hmm. And also my parents live in London, so I can, so I've actually only just, like, I've been living with them for a while, not very glamorous or any of these kind of things. Like, it's not a glamorous life, but it gives me so much purpose to know that I know the problem so well and I think I have the capacity to solve it.
Yeah, brilliant. So what was the stage? How did you start to build the tech?
Yeah, so I'm non-technical.
The big barrier, isn't it, for everybody? Like, yeah, building something.
Yeah. So I'm non-technical, which I always want to preface this kind of discussion with, in the sense that I'm not the one coding it. Mm-hmm. However, we begun by making loads of mistakes, as all startups do. So we outsourced and we built with teams that we didn't properly vet, just to get something out there, which was beneficial in the sense that the best way to test your assumptions is by just putting something on the market. So we had a beta product that, between you and I, was kind of shit, but it did the job.
Between like, you and I, you've just said it on the podcast.
Between you and I, everyone listening, yeah. I'm far too transparent, but I think imagine having a social media company lead that's transparent. Wow.
Yeah.
That's the kind of world I want to live in. So I will never not be honest about my experiences or what we're doing with any part of the company, including you know, data, for example. That's all something that I think should be out there in the open. But yeah, so we made loads of mistakes by kind of just wanting to push forward and not really understanding how long these things take or the best people to bring in. And finding our CTO was a struggle for months. And there was times when we were like, shit, we may have to actually stop this because we can't find the technical expertise that we need to back us. And then we found an incredible guy called Adisham, who is based in London. He's actually originally from Pakistan, which is where a lot of our developers come from. And we managed to build a team who are epic and share our drive and enthusiasm and are young and want to build the next biggest social network with us.
So did you bring them on in terms of equity? Because one of the things I was going to ask is around how you're sort of financially bootstrapping this, because it's really difficult. You can only really afford to outlay for critical expenditure, can't you? So I just wondered like how you kind of set out with that bootstrapping mindset, and especially when that came to sort of growing the team as well.
I mean, I think the bootstrap mindset is a great one. Like, I personally think that that's exactly the place that you should start with. And actually, I've seen way bigger businesses try to mimic that bootstrap mindset in way mm-hmm. bigger teams. You want to work like a startup. I mean, it's something that people talk about all the time. Especially, I mean, I work in a lot of the creative pursuits of the company, and having such a small marketing budget leads to me taking on really ambitious ideas but having to do them in the most weird way.
Yeah. And it's creative though, isn't it?
No, completely. And I absolutely love the challenge. And there's, I mean, one of my favorite quotes is give me the freedom of a restricted brief. And that's basically what a bootstrap or a limited budget is that you have certain rules that you have to work within, or restrictions, but it makes you push past boundaries. So in that way, bootstrapping, I think, is at the stage where I is a benefit. And if you weren't thinking in that way, then I don't know, maybe I don't think it'd be beneficial for the growth of the company. In terms of equity, I mean, we have like incentivization schemes and all of that. I mean, all of that stuff is, we're kind of working out the best way to do it, but we do have people that need to have equity.
Fab. Okay. So in terms of obviously your technical build and then your go-to-market strategy, sort of how and when did you start to do that and what channels did you use?
So we originally, when we were still at Oxford, we started building a bit of an Instagram presence as an account that just shared stuff that was going on. So to find out all the events that were going on at Oxford, it took me hours. I do it on Sunday nights. I'd scroll through Facebook to find events. I'd go through Instagram to find events. I'd message people. I'd say, hey, are you putting on a club night? I'd ask the clubs, is there a club night? I'd look at their websites, put together a database of stuff that was going on. And then I'd summarize the best ones in an Instagram post and be like, I used to call it sneak peek of the week. And I used to say, guys, this is the sneak peek of the week. Basically just wanted to build up a brand voice in pursuit, like in helping promote stuff that was going on. We managed to build up a couple thousand followers just from doing that pre-product. So we didn't actually have anything to give. We just wanted to give value first. And then obviously this was helped by the fact that we were at Oxford. And then when we left Oxford, we still had a big network there. And now I basically use Instagram and LinkedIn as my two main tools. And we're beginning to get into TikTok as well. But that seems to, I get a lot of LinkedIn inbound actually from students. Weirdly, students are starting to get on LinkedIn, which I love. And now I actually found the incredible girl who's working with us to help expand to London. She reached out on LinkedIn and she was like, I just love what you're doing. I think we're doing it I think people respond quite well to our branding. Our content is very silly and not a lot of tech companies have such silly content. And I think it's doing quite well.
Yeah, I mean, I think not a lot of companies can afford to be silly or feel worried about it, but because of the space you're in and the people you're talking to, you have got that license to, I suppose, push the boundary and make a mistake, because no one's gonna cancel you if you do make a mistake or drop a swear word here or there. Whereas I suppose if you're dealing with B2B, potentially it's a bit different. So in terms of revenue, obviously you have, it's like a marketplace, I suppose, isn't it? You've got to get all of the events on and work with the relevant unions, etc. But what about kind of selling into the actual universities themselves? Is that how it's monetized? Are they your customer as well?
So our main customers, the product is really optimized for the student organizers, student societies, and the student experience. And that's a very intentional choice. We spoke to Oxford as in like the people at the top, the tech kind of people at the top, and it takes a long time to get things through. It's quite bureaucratic, the whole system. And actually what we really want to be is that we're going from bottom up rather than top down.
Yeah.
So the student is very much our customer. Selling as a B2B SaaS model to universities is definitely an option down the line. Mm-hmm. Because we actually posit ourselves, as I kind of mentioned, is a bit of a mental health solution as well, because it's really about organizing a database. So it's kind of comes across in so many of their different categories of things they need support with, sort of operations and also well-being. That's definitely an option, and we've had interest, but right now we don't want to get distracted by that. We want to build the best product for our customers and our students and not suddenly get waylaid and make it, you know, take a load of boxes that...
Yeah.
University.
Because you have to start compromising, I think, then, in terms of what you are and who you are, don't
certainly
you?
If we're small, we have to compromise. So we want to grow to a stage where because we know how to build this product for the people that need it most.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually a mistake I think a couple of our predecessors who have tried to solve the problem have made, and we're not going to fall into that trap.
Well, I think it's you're very customer centric. I can tell that immediately, which is great, because without customers, you don't have a business. If you then start to look at selling this to, you know, the CFO or the finance department of the relevant universities, they're looking at different tick boxes, which is fine, but you're not necessarily going to get the engagement. Then you deliver a platform that doesn't have engagement. So I absolutely think for what it's worth, you're doing it the right way. So just give us a bit of an update in terms of where the business is at the moment. So you've got an MVP, I think.
Yeah. So we launched officially in Oxford in October, and that went really well. And we're having monthly growth kind of month on month. It's we actually just sent out our investor update yesterday, and I was going through all the stats being like, yeah, hell yeah, here we go. And our social media has grown hugely recently. Our engagements have gone up by like 2,000%. It's mental. So things are on the up. Obviously that brings a lot of difficulties in itself. Every new kind of stage you get to is a whole new set of challenges. At the moment, we are focusing on really perfecting the product, so getting product market fit within a focus community, so that is Oxford, optimizing the product. And then we're looking to expand to 5 to 6 other universities in the approaching academic year, and starting to start that process already with networking and marketing and the like. But yeah, hopefully you'll hear about us a lot more. And we'll be coming to Manchester, not yet, but soon.
Oh, excellent. You'll have to let me know when you're coming up. But so I wanted to just touch on the fundraising aspect. Obviously, you have bootstrapped, you've created an idea, you've demonstrated traction, and I know that you have had some pre-seed funding. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how that process went, really, and any sort of advice or learnings that you've had.
Yeah, it's such a tricky one. So we have raised a pre-seed angel round, and we're in conversations with actually some VCs at the moment who have begun to show interest, which is kind of fun. But I would really recommend anyone starting out with an idea, especially in the current climate, to bootstrap and then angel and then VC, kind of in that order. Like, don't jump to think that you're VC backable before you are. It may not even be beneficial to bring in the kind of pressure that VCs add so early on. It could break you before it boosts you. So really think about who you're getting money from, not just that you're getting money. Ultimately, if you just need like a bridge round, but like, these are investors, they're going to be on your journey with you. And I think that that's something I wish someone had kind of talked. We kind of fell into doing that naturally, but we could have so easily not have. Getting money right now, it's a really, really difficult time, especially for like consumer tech startups, especially social networks. There hasn't really been a single social network really successfully, particularly not a unicorn from the UK. So it's not like people are used to this happening. I mean, less is still one with, you know, a female co-founder. We're not your average. People don't expect it. All the companies like ours come from the Bay Area. So what we really try to leverage on is storytelling and surprise, and being like, the future needs to look different, and it needs to be led by people that look different. And that is me and my co-founder, and what we're building looks different and feels different. And the response we have from people is super positive in that way. But it took a lot longer than we thought it was going to take to get money. I think we kind of went in doe-eye being like, yeah, they're going to love the idea, they're going to love us. And then we realized, oh shit, okay. And now we're so detailed with our pitch. I think our pitch is on like, I don't even know what version number, but like, we've revised it so many times, and month on month, things change in the business, things change who you're talking to. You have to revise it for different people. We have a data room that is like very meticulous as well. We've been really complimented on the detail there for such an early stage company, but I really recommend getting ahead with that stuff. Okay. So we try and run our operations like we're a company bigger than we are, but everything else, you know, we're very much at the early stage.
Fab. And in terms of your company size, how many employees or how many people do you have in the team?
So we have my co-founder and myself, we have a CTO, and then we have four developers, one's part-time.
Yeah. And on the angel, the pre-seed side, obviously you said like you thought everyone was going to love it. And I think one of the things that's really important to remember is people can still love it, but not necessarily invest. Like, the rejections don't mean that you've got a bad business. I imagine you probably did have some rejections in that
oh my
space.
God, yeah. I actually thrive a bit off that, though. I mean, like, especially if you get into the part of the internet that's all about the rejections that famous people have had, and then you just feel like you're in a very privileged community of people that don't know. You know, I mean, especially some of my heroes, like Canva, Melanie Perkins. I mean, the amount of no's she got, and the amount, I mean, the same things that people are saying to all these people, Airbnb, they're saying to us.
Yeah.
You know, what's the market opportunity, all of this kind of stuff. And we just love the opportunity to prove people wrong, especially in creative ways, actually. We just did something quite crazy with an investor who asked us a question, and we made a short documentary in response. And I absolutely love just surprising people with how far we'll go to prove them wrong. And also, as someone, I've been told no in like a lot of scenarios, like, you know, other projects I've worked with. And every time people tell me that I can't do something, I'm literally like, right, well, you've just given me more reasons to prove that I can.
And I think, you know, in terms of like that entrepreneurial quality, if you're somebody that is highly sensitive to rejection and knockbacks. Possibly the startup life might not be right for you.
No. Yeah. I mean, a lot of jobs, anything where you're really putting yourself out there. So that's a lot of the performance industries as well. And I actually am really inspired. Something I love looking at is actors talk about their early careers and the amount of rejections they had at auditions. And, you know, people will say, like, it's not personal. Like, it is personal. Rejection is personal. And it always is, because they don't like something about you or what you're doing. But yeah, if you're someone that responds really badly to that, I would maybe, or take this as an opportunity to get better at dealing with rejection. Because once you realize that rejection is just can be redirection, to kind of say a bit of a cringe phrase, it just completely reshapes how you think about stuff. And really nothing is a no. It's just like a, okay, not you, but I'll find something else. Like, I'll do it in a different way. And I'm happy I know now that that wasn't going to work.
Fab, thank you. So obviously you've been on a bit of a journey in the last 18 months. I'd say it's a successful journey based on everything that you've said today. You've raised, you've got traction.
Give me the highlights.
Yeah, but you've still talked about the fact that, you know, your first tech development was awful. You know, there's been mistakes as well. What's next for uni? Like, what can we expect to see? What do we need to look out for?
More mistakes, I'm sure. More fast failures. I genuinely think that it's just a race to who can fail the quickest and then learn the fast. Like, that's how you do it. And so I'm sure we'll be getting a lot more stuff wrong, but then ultimately getting a lot more stuff right. So in terms of what's next, we're kind of perfecting the product within Oxford, and that's going well. We have Uni version 2 coming out on the 1st of March. I'm in the process of putting towards a campaign about that, and that will be launched with a lot of optimized features. I'm really excited about the stuff that is going to come from that. A lot of it is like very much customer led. We really let them, like, what do you want us to add to this? Let's have a community platform that's very much built by the community. So we've implemented a lot of that, and then we're expanding, which is super exciting. And yeah, trying to make uni happen and elevate the student experiences in other universities as well.
Fab. Thank you. Thank you so much, George. That's really interesting. It's a very different, I suppose it's a very different business actually to some of a lot of the ones that we have on, because you are so focused on your niche, which is universities and students and what you're delivering for them. But nonetheless, like, a lot of the themes that you've talked about today around, like, making mistakes, failing fast, learning how to handle rejection are really, you know, what all successful entrepreneurs talk about. So it's been really useful. Thank you very much for coming on. Hopefully you'll come back in a couple of months or a bit later on towards the end of the year and give us an update in terms of how uni's going.
I'd love to. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Hopefully I'll have lots to report.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you. And if anybody is listening to this and wants to get in touch or find out more, actually, I should have said that earlier on, what's the best way of connecting with you?
Well, follow us on Instagram, which is at uni.ox, and connect with me on LinkedIn, and definitely reach out if you have any questions about any of the things I've touched on, or if you're interested in getting involved, or you want uni to come to your university.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Georgia. Thank you, everybody. We'll be back next week with another brilliant founder story for you.
I think that just about wraps things up here. If you have any thoughts or questions on anything we said today, get in touch, whether that be through our Twitter at RealTSF or email at hello@startupfactory.tech, or feel free to drop in for a coffee and a chat. As ever, thanks for listening.